The Spider, the Cholera King, 8. Chapter 8. The Exodus. All the day, the spider's thousands marched, carrying everything before them. Hourly their ranks grew thicker as increasingly more people deserted the plague-infested homes to join the Exodus. The subways were seized and hurtled their hundreds to the extreme limits of their lines. Elevated trains, buses, streetcars and automobiles all did their share. And in spite of that, many thousands traveled on foot, a great, growing army which filled the streets to overflowing, which crowded the city from river to river, stampeding to the northward in the hope of life. It was noon when the first great cohorts of the spider's army reached the quarantine line at the city's northern boundaries. A scant dozen men were on guard there and they watched the increasing hundreds who thrust against their bulwark with mounting anxiety. Wentworth knew that they had phoned for aid, that he must act decisively before that help arrived. Now, the thousands might pass the frontier without bloodshed. Later, he went forward with two men at his back to parley with the guard, and faced leveled rifles with gleaming bayonets fixed. Wentworth smiled, and waved a careless hand toward the weapons. "You can kill me," he announced quietly, "but you are here to preserve life, not to destroy it, and you cannot possibly wipe out the thousands behind me. The population of New York is moving northward to find pure water and a chance for life." The leader of the guards faltered before the assault of Wentworth's direct gaze. He was a sergeant of the state police, and he was a brave man, but he looked beyond Wentworth to the marching thousands who pressed on through the sweltering heat of the day, crowding against the forward ranks now waiting at the barriers. Already those front ranks were feeling the inexorable forward thrust of them. The leader of the guards realized that their eventual advance would be as difficult to resist as the tides of the sea. Let the men kill all those that they now could see, even and the dead would be pressed on against them. The gun sagged in the sergeant's hand. "God," he whispered, "I can't stop you." Wentworth nodded. "Not you, nor all the troops in the state." He lifted his clenched fist above his head, swept it to the north. Behind him, the thousands lifted their voices in a great shout. "Forward!" A bugle trumpeted amid them. Someone had caught it up in fleeing his home and the shouts became a cheer. The state police stood white-faced and watched them throng past, hundreds on hundreds treading on each other's heels, striped with sweat, some carrying bundles over their shoulders, others clinging to the sides of trucks and autos loaded with women and with foodstuffs. The girl who had wept in the dawn went past them, walking with straight, graceful strides, her eyes unwavering. The other woman staggered beside her, hand pressed to her chest, but her head was not bowed. The girl carried the baby, riding it high on her shoulders, and their lips moved as if in song. The marchers scarcely glanced at the armed men, their faces 5XED with a glory, a terrible, urgent glory forward, to life. The sergeant turned to his men. "The whole damned city's marching," he exclaimed hoarsely. "Did you know that man in the lead?" The private beside him shook his head, but his eyes remained on the marching hordes. "No, but by God, he was a man." The woman turned her head toward them and smiled. "He is a man," she cried softly. "His strength will carry us on." The girl laughed and bounced the baby on her shoulders. The sergeant nodded crisply. "It was the spider. By God, I'd like to follow him." He looked down at his uniform, at the badge on his breast. He was not a young man, Sergeant Mallory. His job in the pension aid would bring were the only things he had to look forward to in life, to support him and his wife now that the children were all on their own. And yet the urge was in him to forget this uniform and the badge upon his breast. When he looked at those marching thousands, there was something that caught in his throat like a sob. Marching I and the hope of life, behind that splendid man. The spider. The sob pushed into Mallory's mouth. He spun to face his men and had to swallow hard before he could speak. He brought up his right hand slowly and seized the badge, wrenched it from his coat and hurled it to the ground. "If that badge keeps me from saving the people, to hell with it," he said harshly. "If those people don't march, they'll die. I'm going to help the spider." His men gaped at him. The first private pulled his eyes away from the horde. He grinned. Then he ripped his badge off his own chest. "Want to make that an order, Sergeant?" The sergeant's lips compressed to hide his own grin. "It's no order, no. But any man that doesn't go has no soul in him and no heart." He laughed. "Hell, yes, it's an order. Detail, fall in, attention. By the left flank, march. Double time, march." They passed the ragged marchers with a grim steadiness which pulled many eyes toward them. A young man leaped into their path, brandishing a revolver. "You ain't going to hurt the spider," Sergeant Mallory panted. "Hell, no, son, we're going to help him." The man with the gun stepped aside, cheering. Other voices caught it up. The police are with us. Therefore the spider. Long before the police had reached the front ranks where the spider strode, he knew of their coming. These men who joined him were sacrificing their jobs, but God knew he needed their help. This mob must be organized and leaders appointed to guard over them at night, to dole out food and watch water supplies, to aid the stricken and to destroy the dead, to enforce rules of sanitation. His heart lifted. His step was lighter. He would win through for these people because they trusted him, because he must. His cause was just and it would triumph. He did not halt the march when the dozen state police fell into step behind him. He clasped Sergeant Mallory's hand. "I'll see to it that you don't suffer for this, any of you, men. There'll be work which only disciplined men can do this night." The dusk was gathering when finally Wentworth called a halt but not a rest. For him, at least, there could be no rest. The police and the few reliable men he had gathered around him went back through the crowd, dividing it into small companies, choosing the most likely man to head each group, apportioning the food and trucks and automobiles. More thousands arrived throughout the night and the work went on endlessly. The head of the march was 10 miles beyond the city limits and its rear had not yet left the canyons of New York. All along its length, fires burned, cook fires and the biers of the dead. Abandoned buildings were filled with the bodies of those who died in the night and fires were set to them. The stench of burning human flesh clung to the refugees as they marched on the next morning. There were those who wept as they plodded on, and there were others who marched with dull and staring eyes. But today, they marched in some semblance of order, the companies grouped about the trucks and the autos which had been assigned to them, taking turns riding when the weak grew too weary to walk farther, seizing food supplies as they advanced, commandeering the milk trucks they met, seizing bottled goods from every shop they passed. The penalty for drinking water was death. From the roadside where they had been laid in the shade, those marchers who were stricken with the cholera cried out for the others to save them, to carry them on or just to kill them. They cried unceasingly for drink and their pitiful wailings, too, became a part of the long trek. There could be no mercy, no pity for the dying, for their very existence was a peril to those whom they besieged, a peril which all had abandoned their very homes and beloved dead to evade. Vain as it was, the girl went time and again to those sufferers and gave them to drink. She was weary with a tiredness which gnawed at her bones. The thin shoes were worn from her feet, but an inner strength carried her on. "If I die," she whispered to the woman, "it won't matter much. I'll never love another man. Not after seeing him." The woman smiled, hugged her child closer to her breast. "My husband died of the cholera. They wouldn't even let me wash his face. There's a sick woman needing a drink, honey." At night, those who were marching past at the time burned the sick who had died beside the line of march, and those who had drunk water were executed. There would be no need to repeat that salutary justice this second night, Wentworth knew, and thanked his God. His mouth was grim with pain as the order to fire was given. "Murderer!" a man shouted. "You're in league with the plague master." The girl was crying. She turned on the man. "Fool!" she sobbed. "Fool, can't you see how it hurts him?" Another man caught the objector by the shoulder. "If they live, they may kill a dozen men and women apiece," he explained quietly. "It's just like they were traitors to an army, or a spy." There were others who cried out, too. If Wentworth heard, he paid no heed. Sergeant Mallory spoke to them, briefly, with a trace of a smile about his wide, solid lips. "If you don't like this army, go back where you came from. There's plenty of room in the city now." To Wentworth, the nights and days alike were nightmares beyond endurance. If he slept at all, it was in dozing snatches during the day's march when infrequently he mounted the fire truck which still led the exodus. He carried the whole burden of the march upon his shoulders, and in the eyes of those who served with him there was something close to worship as he drove them on. The state sent companies of National Guardsmen from the north to halt the advance. They entrenched across the roadways that the exodus followed, and Wentworth walked alone to meet the commander. They talked in the colonel's tent. He was an older man than Wentworth, one under whom Major Wentworth had served in the World War. They stood facing each other, unexhausted, unrecognizable man in a dingy black velvet cape, whose eyes burned with the wool which alone held him erect, and a soldier, spruce in his khaki, a strong man, too, with the steel of bayonets in his glance. "The march must stop," he insisted. "Your people must turn back to the city." "To die?" Wentworth hurled at him. "There are millions in this march, millions of human souls. Yesterday, 7,000 men and women fell beside the road with cholera, as nearly as I can figure, today only 3,000 felt. Don't you see what it means? They are marching away from the disease. They are winning the right to live. The cholera has a short incubation period, 48 hours at the most. 48 hours after we leave the city, the last of those infected there will be stricken. Within a week, we will have left behind the last of those who were infected in the city. There will still be infection. Men can carry the germs in their bodies for several months, but once we have left it behind, we can isolate those germ carriers. You can spread the infection across the whole countryside, Colonel Brooks said coldly. You will turn your people back, or my men will open fire. Wentworth stood looking at him, smiled slightly. Do you think that your three companies can halt 3 millions? They will walk you into the earth with their bare feet, hammer you to pulp with their bare fists. True, you will kill many of them, but there is a greater fear behind them than the fear of your guns. Colonel Brooks, if we spread infection in every city on our path and we are avoiding cities, there will still be fewer deaths than if you turn these people back into New York. Colonel Brooks shook his head sharply. I have my orders. You will turn back. We will not turn back, Colonel Brooks. Wentworth said it quietly. His hands crossed beneath his lapels and two heavy automatics leaped to his palms. There was a lieutenant in the tent with Colonel Brooks and one of the spider's guns covered each man. If either of you opens his lips, Wentworth said shortly, you both die. Colonel Brooks sniffed. He opened his lips and Wentworth leaped forward. Striking with the muzzle of the gun, the lieutenant whipped his sword from its scabbard and Wentworth knocked its tip aside with a blow of one gun, stepped close and slugged with the other. He stared down grimly at the two unconscious men for a moment. He began talking. I implore you, Colonel Brooks, he said, to see this thing my way. Not thousands, but tens of thousands of lives are at stake. If you let us go through, he went on talking, while he bent over the colonel and swiftly stripped off his uniform, binding the man as he did so. He put his cape and hat on the lieutenant and sat him in a camp chair beside the table. His bound head hid his face. The limp Colonel Wentworth thrust into a shadowy corner. Then he swiftly donned the officer's clothing. He stepped to the door, jerked up the flap, and when he spoke, it was as if Colonel Brooks stood behind him, ordering, "Sentry, summon the bugler," Wentworth ordered. When the bugler came, his eyes started wide as sight of Wentworth's unfamiliar face beneath the colonel's hat, but a gun in the spider's hand, even though it hung idly at his side, prevented his raising an alarm. "Sound recall," Wentworth ordered shortly. Sergeant Mallory stood at the boundary of the camp, waiting, peering toward him. Wentworth lifted his clenched fist over his head as the bugle sounded, swung his arm stiffly toward the north and pointed. Mallory did not understand why Wentworth's signal should be given by a colonel, but he understood the meaning. He whirled toward the hordes. "Forward," he cried, and repeated the signal. "Forward," chanted the marching horde. "Forward." In the absence of orders from the commander, the soldiers did nothing. Wentworth saw runners start toward him from the entrenched positions and he smiled slightly, waiting. If these who marched were their fellow people, their own people without orders from the colonel, they would wait. The runners came toward Wentworth at the double. Wentworth stepped inside the tent and let the flap fall, awing the bugler inside with him. None would enter without command. He, too, had seen Sergeant Mallory striding through the camp and only him did he admit. "You were a captain during the war?" Wentworth asked. The sergeant nodded, staring at the unconscious colonel in the corner, at the lieutenant in the spider's cape, at Wentworth in the colonel's uniform. Wentworth began to take it off. "You're in charge of these companies," he said. "March them to the vanguard of our line and keep them there. They'll be a buffer against any other troops we meet. We can say that the march is in charge of the troops and is headed for a specified camping place." He laughed shortly. "Colonel Mallory, you have superseded Colonel Brooks." Wentworth doubted that he would convince the captains and lieutenants wholly of the replacement. He would speak to them, tell them that orders from Albany had been changed, that they would march with the horde. Then an armed man would keep at each officer's elbow at all times. He thought that he could handle the situation. Once more in his own clothing, he stepped out of the tent, with Mallory, in the colonel's uniform, at his side. "Bugler," Mallory said sharply. "Sound assembly. Runners, return to your units and tell your officers to assemble their companies in their company streets." The runners hesitated. One of them stepped forward, begging the colonel's pardon. "Sir, But Colonel Brooks has been superseded. Sergeant Mallory announced shortly. Return to your units and obey orders, he whispered to Wentworth. I always wanted to be a colonel. The runners went away swiftly. Wentworth turned and shook Mallory's hand. You can do it, he said confidently. I think it would be better if I weren't by you when you face them all. Mallory smiled with wide, firm lips. I'll handle them. Wentworth hurried to the head of his horde, and an hour later, four companies of the National Guard passed at the double and took their positions at the head of the line of march. A lieutenant dropped back and de-clicked his heels before Wentworth. Colonel Mallory's compliments, sir, he said. And will you join him at the head of the column? Wentworth nodded somberly, but he was gay. He had found a man in Mallory. 2 days more of this march would take them to the place that Wentworth had chosen, and by the time most of the plague should have been left behind. He ordered the fire truck on which he rode sent swiftly forward. His mind was made up. He would leave Mallory, Colonel Mallory, in charge and go back to New York City. Somewhere there, the master of the plague still ruled, and the spider's task would not be done until he affixed his small crimson seal to the butcher's forehead. The spider's lips were smiling as he shot forward. Tomorrow, he would be able to join in a decisive battle against the plague master. End of chapter 8.